Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you. So Maysoon stood in for Jane this morning to kind of get the session rolling, and then Jane came in and said, you know, I had to be in two places at the same time, but she was being very modest. So I want to take a moment before I get going to let you all know that Jane, during this week's conference, was elected a fellow of the American Society of Agronomy, so she was out for the breakfast to honor her new membership. It's very well deserved. So the concept of soil health, very holistic concept, has really garnered a lot of attention, not only by scientists, but a lot of imagination and creativity by farmers and ranchers, not only in the U.S., but across the world. And we've typically been using, you know, the concept of soil health for looking at how we address things like drought and basically kind of climate change adaptation. But when Jane asked me to really kind of focus on the mitigation components too, so I'm going to, you know, you can't do one without the other in my mind. So I think they're intricately linked. But I also wanted to kind of use this opportunity to kind of lay out some of the importance of why we really need to focus on both the adaptation and the mitigation. We know from ice core data, tree ring data, coral reef data, that over the last 1,000 years, that the temperatures that we've been seeing in the last 1 to 2 decades have been the hottest on record for the last 1,000 years. There's about 14 different primary climate change models that have really been doing a good job of predicting increases in temperature. And those 14 different models are telling us that, on average, this is what's coming over the next 84 years. So when you think of that increased temperature, what that's going to mean to our ability to grow food for this burgeoning population, right now we're about 7.3 billion people, going to be up to around 9.5 just by the year 2050. Generally, on a shrinking available land base, you think, okay, there's increased temperature, that means increased evaporation. Well, what does that mean for our fish and wildlife habitat? What does that mean for what we're doing for drawing down our aquifers? What does it mean for air quality? More dust flying around. I mean, the list really kind of goes on and on of the impact that this is going to have. We know that we're seeing this already, much more extreme weather events, not just things like historic droughts that are occurring with more frequency. But the reason I'm showing this historic drought in 2012 is because where that drought was most intense, the previous year, do you know what was being experienced in that part of the U.S.? Record floods, historic floods. So we need systems, our crop food production systems, to be more resilient to these extreme weather events. And given even moderate levels of greenhouse gas emissions, the predictions are by just the middle of this century, from 2036 to 2065, that we're going to be experiencing, many states are going to be experiencing, over 18 additional drought months. Of course, a key practice for addressing both the adaptation component and the mitigation component is no-till. The adaptation being, of course, that the residue on the surface helps keep the soil cooler, more moist. But also that mitigation component is when that residue decomposes, goes through that process of humification, and becomes really part of that soil organic carbon, then you can essentially, you know, sequester carbon in the soil, provide that mitigation component. Now, I thought it would be useful just to take a real quick look, and I'm going to throw up some tables with a lot of numbers, but just a quick look on what research is showing us of the impact from no-till for really increasing soil organic carbon. So the next few slides are going to be this same format. We have a column of the location, the number of years in the study, the depths that were sampled, the soil grate group, soil organic carbon and conventional till, then soil organic carbon and no-till, then the author of the study. So you can just see right here in Alabama, Iowa, Illinois, a bunch of Illinois over different periods of time, mostly at 30, one study there at 20 centimeters, a number of different grape groups significantly able to increase organic carbon by converting to no-till. You can see the numbers. I won't, don't need to read them all to you. So here comes a whole nother set. Okay, so now these are more in Illinois, some Indiana, some Kentucky studies. There's a couple of declines. There's a couple. This is research, right? We still have data is what data is. It's not always perfect in terms of what, you know, conforming to the models of what you think is going to happen. So, but I was not selective. I pulled out what I found. Okay, so there's a whole nother set. Here comes another set. A bunch of more studies in Kentucky. Now we're picking up some studies in Nebraska. And some of these, you know, have been highly weathered soils, or paleoudalt, so highly weathered ultisol, and then more of kind of the, I guess, kind of the premier soil of the world of mollisols also, argilludols. Generally increasing organic carbon. Okay, here's another set. So Ohio, Mexico, Ontario, Saskatchewan, some real significant increases in organic carbon. And then the last slide, three studies in Spain, again, increases. So I just showed you 26 studies. 23 of them showed that we were able to increase soil organic carbon through no-till. And so it's pretty convincing that we know how to do this, that we can do this. And the gentleman asked earlier, asked Suzanne about her question after her presentation, regarding, well, how do we get, you know, farmers to do this? How do we get farmers to increase their soil organic carbon? And so that's kind of what I want to talk about for a few minutes. And, of course, a big part of that, how we get there, is really focusing in on knowing the landowners. In the U.S., about 70% of the land is privately owned, about 30% publicly owned. But even those privately owned acres, increasingly, they are the people that own the land are not the farmers. There are some states, 40 to 60% of the farmland is what's called or is owned by what's called absentee landowners, non-operator landowners. So if we just focus on what farmers are going to be needing, what turns their crank to raise their interest in increasing organic carbon, we could be in some states missing half of the opportunity for influencing changes on the landscape. So we also really need to be thinking about the general public that still owns that land. They've inherited it or they've invested in it, bought it as a business investment. But my point is that we can't just think of the farmers. If someone has a 1, 2, 3 year lease, then they generally have less incentive to make these investments to enhance soil health. So it's about knowing your client. It's about addressing those landowner interests. And so if you are a farmer, you're really interested in enhancing your productivity and resilience. And there are a lot of different, you know, components of that. One of them is, again, building this adaptation to things like drought, enhancing, optimizing your available water holding capacity. So what's really needed there? We know, in general, this relationship holds true. When you increase soil organic carbon, you increase the available water holding capacity. You could, you know, it fans out, right, as you go. By my calculations, if you increase the organic carbon by 1%, then you generally increase a soil's capacity to hold plant available water by anywhere from 2,500 gallons to 12,000 gallons per acre in the top 6 inches. Of course, there's variability in that. But so what is needed to really kind of operationalize this relationship? One is that these relationships do differ for different soils. This was a sandy soil here, but it is different for silty clays and sandy loams and silt loams. And so that's one of the first steps, or the big research steps, is really mining a lot of the data that's out there and developing those relationships for the different soils, seeing how far we can generalize out, And then in my mind, the next kind of pseudo-research need is taking some of our existing models. We have some really valuable models of that decomposition, that humification, of how that crop residue decomposes and actually becomes part of that soil organic carbon. Now think of the power if we could now take those existing models with these types of known relationships, marry them into a decision support tool that's farmer friendly to allow them to play around with different scenarios like different cropping systems, rotations, tillage practices, to achieve a targeted level of resilience, a targeted level of increased water holding capacity. I think that's really achievable. And that's one of actually of our priorities in the Soil Health Institute that we are wanting to support. Another, obviously, that's, you know, would be of interest to farmers is optimizing water infiltration. We know that it's dependent on aggregation, bulk density, particle size, sand, silt, and clay, antecedent moisture content when it does rain, how fast it rains, all those things, ground cover. But farmers are seeing this. They're seeing differences in water infiltration depending on these, what we call soil health promoting practices or not. On the left in the no-till, on the right, obviously it's not. And it's the water's ponded on the right. And you all, many of you soil scientists, you know what's happening. So the unprotected soil on the right, the individual sand, silt, and clay particles, you know, they aggregate, but when the water raindrops hit them, it disintegrates those aggregates. Disaggregates? There you go. That's the word. I'll use that one. Breaks down the aggregates. And the individual sand, silt, and clay particles, you know, they settle out. And now, so what's happening here is not only is there that societal impact of water running off, nutrients running off with it into the nearby lakes and streams, but on the right side there, in that field on the right, that farmer is losing the opportunity to recharge that soil with moisture as to the same extent as the on the farm on the left. So it's not going to have as much moisture available when they need it when in periods of drought. So farmers are seeing this. We also know, obviously, it's over 1,200 data points. We increase organic carbon. You're reducing the density of the soil. So that influences things like infiltration. And here's another combining some studies that I've pulled together of looking at, again, different locations, different years, different tillage systems and crop systems. The one in Kansas, when they add, even though they had no-till already, when they added cover crop, they increased infiltration rate by 182%. The next one down, depending on, there was a number of studies, 164% to 462%. But Kansas, 132% to 194%. The list, it kind of goes on and on. So these are some real significant, I think, messages to those farmers, why you need to increase your organic carbon, what it's going to do for them. But again, you've got to know, you know, your target audience. Another, obviously, is that farmers would be really interested in is disease suppression. Why do these soil health promoting practices that generally increase soil organic carbon, provide that, you know, greenhouse gas mitigation component, why are they interested in those soil health promoting practices? And another one is disease suppression. It's not just through things like with the rotation systems that, you know, can help break up disease cycles. But I really feel like that in many respects, it's largely untapped information. What's referred to as the microbiome or the phytobiome is what is really going on underneath the surface, in the rhizospheres, and how those different types of cover crops, and with this case, this is a clover interseeded with a barley. Maybe this was oats here, I guess. But how they interact in that rhizosphere, and what influence that has on the microbial community, and what does that mean for nutrient availability? What does it mean for disease suppression? And this is just two species here, obviously very different. One of them, when the grain crop is harvested, you're going to be left with, you know, quite lignified material above the ground. Not so sure about what's going on below ground. But then obviously mixed with a legume, something that's very labile, easily attacked, decomposed by the microbes. So now what happens when these two are mixed? Very different, really kind of labilities for the microbial populations to attack. But we have farmers now that are growing 6, 8, 10 different types of cover crops, mixes. And in many respects, I feel like we don't know what's going on in that rhizosphere. We don't know the influence that's having on the microbial communities. And so I feel like that's kind of a largely untapped area of research for us that we need to learn more information about so that we have an opportunity for managing it for the benefit of things like disease suppression, nutrient availability. So that's another real key area, and a key area of research I feel like needs to be conducted on these soil health promoting systems that also influence the carbon sequestration potential. And so then another kind of key area is really under the heading of quantifying and enhancing environmental benefits. And so here it's not just what interests the farmers and ranchers, but what interests society. So farmers and ranchers, you know, every time we have, you know, the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone occurs, and we know it's going to occur every year. It's never a question of if it's going to occur. It's going to always a question of how big is it going to be. Chesapeake Bay, you know, the Western Lake Erie Basin, all these nutrient loading issues that we're having in many of these water bodies, every time that happens, the drumbeat of regulation rings louder and louder. For farmers. And since it's election day, I'll use this as an opportunity to get on my soapbox just for a minute and say that, you know, in the U.S., our country was largely built on individual freedoms. And in my estimation, there's no group that personifies that independence more strongly than America's farmers and ranchers. And there are those that predict, no one has a crystal ball, but there are those that predict that once regulation starts to become more and more of a reality, more and more enforced on America's farmers and ranchers, then many of them are going to choose not to farm anymore. And then where will we be? We don't know the answer to that, but I think that we can all speculate it wouldn't be very pleasant. So that's one reason why it's really important to quantify and enhance the environmental benefits of these soil promoting practices. It's a lot of these things like, you know, cover crops and increasing water holding capacity and those things that, you know, environmental benefits that come with that. But then there's the other side, those kind of those market drivers. The consumers interested in how these practices that farmers are using are good also for the environment. So these are other reasons why it's really important for us to quantify things like, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, surface runoff, and nutrients and sediment, and what's coming out the drainage lines. Just last week, I attended what's called the BSR Conference, the Businesses for Social Responsibility Conference in New York City. The person on the right is Ken Powell. He's the CEO of General Mills. And they gave him the first slot on a 2 or 3 day conference as the first keynote speaker. And guess what he talked about? Soil health. He talked about partnerships with the Nature Conservancy and our institute and others, Soil Health Partnership and others. And General Mills, you know, they're like about an $18 billion a year company. They swing a pretty big stick. They can bring in many others. And what's interesting about them is that not only do they have these sustainability goals, like I congratulate, it's very laudable what Monsanto has with, you know, reducing their carbon footprint by 2021, I guess it was. General Mills also has similar types of goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 28% by the year 2025, all through their food chain, and or their supply chain, I should say. And so it's not only are they doing this for the environmental responsibility reasons, but they recognize it is a business imperative for them. Because they're dependent on being able to grow all this food for this burgeoning population, and they're dependent on being able to grow it and then turn around and sell it at an affordable rate. And so to the extent that climate change and all these other factors, you know, the drought, more extreme weather events, all of these other factors influence their ability to provide that product at a reasonable cost, to the producer or the consumer, then it affects their bottom line. So they are seeing this as a business imperative. And so that is kind of another reason, and I think another opportunity for us really focusing in on our carbon mitigation or greenhouse gas mitigation components, but for another real good reason. So there's a number of other things that we really kind of need to do for enhancing our ability to check my time here. For enhancing our ability to provide increased carbon sequestration, and one of them is really come to grips in an understanding and agreement on what the primary measures are for soil health. And so we have been hosting what was called the Soil Renaissance, and now we've inherited through the Soil Health Institute, groups of folks that have been basically kind of debating what are the right measurements for soil health, and then coming up with those standardized operating procedures for measuring it and in the field and in the laboratory. They have a number of different criteria for those indicators, or like for that it represents key soil processes, that it's sensitive to management changes, that it's feasible for the commercial labs. And so what they have come up with was what they're calling Tier 1 indicators. And there's just a wide range of indicators out there, but they have basically said, okay, these are Tier 1. That means they're ready for prime time. We can all agree that these are ready. Things that, you know, are basically widely considered effective, that there are known thresholds. We know it's good, bad, and, you know, or indifferent, and that some of the specific management strategies to achieve that increase in that indicator are known. And some examples are very similar to some of our standard soil tests, quite frankly, already. Some of the things like N, P, and K, soil organic carbon, texture, water-stable aggregates, bulk density, penetration resistance, and they're kind of starting to inch into the biological component by looking at a respiration measure. But what we really need research on is what these call these Tier 2 indicators. We think that they're likely going to be effective for indicating soil health. That will increase the adoption of these practices and therefore increase soil organic carbon, carbon sequestration. But where there's additional research that needs to be conducted for identifying what some of those thresholds are. Some of them have certain laboratory analysis issues. And some of the examples are the beta glucosidase activity, microaggregate stability, permanganate, oxidizable carbon, labile, amino nitrogen, the fatty acid methyl ester analysis, and phospholipid fatty acid analysis. So there are a number of these that are showing a whole lot of potential. I see Jennifer Moore Cusera in the audience. She has been a leader in evaluating PLFA and a number of these and has been extremely involved, as has Doug Carlin here. I'm working with these different committees and different groups to come to grips with the additional research that is needed for each of those to advance them into that kind of Tier 1 status. And so that's another one of our priorities at the Soil Health Institute, conduct, having the research conducted to address that. And then when it kind of comes down to the end of the day, it's like Suzanne was mentioning too, is that we really need to be able to monitor progress. And that starts with quantifying your baseline and then monitoring your progress over time. And so at the Soil Health Institute, we realize it's not just going to be us. We're going to need to engage many, many different partners. But this is basically our approach that we are advocating right now. And again, this is not just us. It's going to be a partnership with USDA NRCS, Ag Retailers Association, Certified Crop Advisors, the Nature Conservancy. The list goes on and on. But I'm sure probably most of you know that most states, they don't only have a state bird and state tree, but they also have a state soil. And so we realize that if we're going to evaluate this suite of measurements across a lot of different soils, having different properties, different cropping systems, different climatic zones, why not just start with these 50? And think of how far that's going to get us, particularly when you think that some of these soils cover several states, like the state soil in South Carolina occurs in about 5 different states. And so we can really cover a lot of ground with our information. And so that's going to be our first step there, is analyzing and evaluating a lot of these different measurements and standards in these state soils. And then another additional step after that is then go to some of the long-term agroecosystem research sites that USDA ARS has, that a number of land grants have. Go to the sites like that the Soil Health Partnership has been sampling and working with farmers where they know, the production history on those lands. Of course, the long-term agroecosystem research sites and some of the land grant sites, there's already a strong experimental design in place. And so that's another way that then we could take an additional step for evaluating all these types of measurements. And then eventually we want to step it up nationally in the U.S. to where we are, engaging all the agribusiness, NRCS, all the local folks for even taking an expanded approach for analyzing the soil health, which a component of it will obviously be the soil organic carbon. Then, of course, we cannot ignore the policy alignment issues. If we ignore them, we ignore them at our peril. And some of them are probably pretty obvious, things like the conservation title in the Farm Bill for those of us in the U.S. That is a way that financial assistance is provided to farmers to help them get over that learning curve when they're starting that new conservation practice that will enhance carbon in their soil. That is a very effective approach. And generally, these are about 3-year contracts. So it's not a long-term commitment. But what it is it's then they generally pay 50 to 75% of the cost of implementing some new practice. But the farmer has skin in the game. And so they have an invested interest in wanting to make sure that practice succeeds. So that's obviously, kind of probably one of the more clear policy issues that I personally feel like that's important for those of us in the U.S. to continue to support and hopefully expand in the future. But then there's other options and opportunities too. Things like if these soil health promoting practices that increase carbon and therefore water holding capacity, it just makes sense that they would reduce economic risk because they are, should provide greater yield stability. Well, then wouldn't it make sense to have policies where now a farmer that goes to get crop insurance might get a cut on their crop insurance premium if they've demonstrated they are a lower risk because they've adopted these practices? When they go to a bank to get a loan, to take out a loan, wouldn't it make sense that if they've demonstrated they are a lower risk because they've adopted these practices that are more resilient to drought, for example, because they increase carbon, they increase water holding capacity, then wouldn't it make sense that they would pay for a lower interest rate for that loan. So there are some of those types of policy tweaks that I think that we really need to look at. And those are some things that we have committees on the Soil Health Institute that are working on looking at too. So our approach, and I know this is a little bit self-serving here, we're just talking a little bit about the Institute, but I wanted to let you know that, you know, all of these things are kind of not just out there floating, but there we have what we feel like is a strategic approach addressing a lot of these, and it's not just Institute members, it's really all the different individuals that volunteer their time and effort that's really going to get things done. We are an Institute of four. Four. So you're looking at a fourth out of the Institute right here. But what we have is lots of different volunteers, from scientists, farmers, ranchers, from ARS, land grants, other industry people that work in labs that have volunteered their time and effort. Just this, our first annual meeting in the end of July, we had 130 people come. And so they didn't, you know, segregating themselves in a different areas from research, economics, et cetera. So our whole approach is basically this, where we're looking at conducting the research, what I'm calling knowledge generation here, for that's our how you, through soil health, increase productivity, increase resilience, things that I just got through talking to you about in a slightly different way. How we quantify those environmental impacts. Already kind of described the justification for it, why we really need to do that. And really focusing in on all those chemical, physical, and biological processes. And there I've talked about that some in terms of disease suppression, but it's also true for nutrient cycling, other things. And we're really kind of focusing in on the processes there because it's through understanding those processes in the soil that's going to allow us to transfer that information across climatic zones, across cropping systems, across other management practices. So that's kind of the research side of it, the knowledge generation side, but then there's the whole adoption side. We haven't got anywhere if we've just conducted the research and published it. And so part of this is assessing that current state of adoption. And that, again, gets back to Suzanne's point of what they plan on the 4 per mil effort, but it also gets back to this National Soil Health Assessment that we want to partner with others to conduct. What is our current state? And when we determine what our current state is of the adoption of these practices and what our current state of soil organic carbon is, guess what? We have cataloged, stored samples of where we know 50 years ago, 70 years ago, what that soil organic carbon was for that soil series. And what's called the typifying pedon, that those samples are still stored at the National Lab there in Lincoln, Nebraska. So with that information, knowing what our current levels are, employing existing models of, okay, what if we incorporated no-till? What if we, you know, added more cover crops? What if we change rotations? Through modeling efforts, we can determine our potential impacts on water quality, providing pollinator habitat, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and that can also help us identify particular areas to target. And then, of course, partnering to enhance the adoption of all these practices is key. And then, again, quantifying the impacts. Now, all of these working groups that we've assembled in Soil Health Institute, things like measurements and standards that I described, they are really bridges. They're bridges for the research, connecting the research to getting that adoption. Things like the economics. What's the potential profitability of these systems? Can we reduce economic risk through these systems? And then that's going to be that bridge for getting increased resilience, but then also bridging that with that increased adoption. And of course, there's the whole communications and education team that's working on communicating those efforts, the policy as a meant, the development, and all of these come together for the Institute for helping us achieve our mission, which is safeguarding and enhancing vitality and productivity of soils. So I guess the bottom line is that through soil health, I think we can really address a lot of these carbon, not only the adaptation, climate change adaptation, but the mitigation needs simultaneously. But it can't just occur at a kind of a haphazard way. Well, we've got dozens of different organizations out doing their own thing. We really need to be very strategic at how all the different partners link so that we can make the most of this opportunity that we currently have. About 2 weeks ago, we brought in about 10 different organizations and spent a couple of days working on how we can strategize, how we can make the most of our efforts and build the synergies that we need kind of in the private world. And once we get our act together, then we're going to then be engaging the public entities, you know, particularly USDA and some others, and seeing how we can then combine forces to be more integrated in terms of our partnering, to be more strategic for these soil health efforts to achieve these goals. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will turn it back over to you, Jay. In this country, are there opportunities to align with the soil health? Yes. Yeah, there are. In fact, a lot of those same groups, like Harold Van Ness, Bianca Mobius Clune, that helped design the soil health, Cornell soil health test, they've been participants in this effort for the Soil Health Institute, what was previously called the Soil Renaissance. Now, so we've incorporated them and a lot of those kind of thought leaders into the Soil Health Institute. So there's a lot of alignment there. There needs to be more, but a lot of these different pieces, that's really kind of what we feel is an important role for the Institute, is to try to bring in those folks and make sure that they are aligned and make sure that we're kind of making the most of the kind of the resources that are put towards these efforts. Any others? Yes, Mike.
Do you consider the public outreach part of the Soil Health Institute mandate? Growers and lawmakers, do you feel like there's something that we can do in society here as well?
As you're talking about this society?
I'm talking about
the big society. Big society. Yeah. The big S. Yeah, you know, we do feel like that is our mandate too, but we feel like that we can't do it alone, that it really requires a lot of partnerships to do it, and that there's other folks like at General Mills and others that we want to team up with that have kind of the that bully pulpit to really kind of get the word out more. And so we feel like that along in that area, one of our primary our primary effort is really research, but then following that is developing some of these educational materials to transfer the research information, that technology, into user-friendly, you know, formats, fact sheets, those types of things. And so at that point, it'll be really kind of reaching out to those people, ag retailers, certified crop consultants, NRCS, people like yourself, those that work directly with farmers and ranchers, the Nature Conservancy, and really try to provide them with that information to help with the adoption. Yes?
I wonder how you see content that's generated through SHI going to coordinate with some of these other organizations that are involved in, like, for example, like the Cover Crop Council, where these essential care passes information. Is that going to be things that are just co-
I think it's really kind of each case is kind of case specific, but I would say in general our doors are wide open, and so if there's been a group that we have not yet reached out to, it's only because there's only so many hours in the day and only so many people, and so one of our guiding principles is open source and transparency, and so there's you know, we are making real concerted efforts to reach out to a number of groups to try to get things coordinated, but there will always be some need for improvement. But we are making some real specific efforts in that way. Just like I say, a couple of weeks ago, we brought in folks from the Nature Conservancy, the Fertilizer Institute, Soil and Water Conservation Society, the Tri-Societies here, this group called the Global Soil Security Effort. I'm missing some of the National Associations for Conservation Districts. Yep, National Corn Growers Association, the Soil Health Partnership. There's others that I'm leaving out right now off the top of my head with that goal of how we actually spent a half a day of just talking about what each different organization was doing, and then the next half a day of how we work together, how we build the synergies, those partnerships. Thanks, Jamie.